Alice prepares a certain state called pre, because that's the pre-selected state. And Bob measures some observable in a system at some later time. And then, they send these systems back and forth. And then Alice measures an observable of which this state post is an eigenstate at some later time. And so she either gets post or some other state. And then she post selects for post. So there's an initial state pre, which is prepared, the final state post, which is selected from the outcomes of the measurements, and a measurement of some observable n at time t2, 3 times t1, t2, t3. Then, if you have a situation like that, then Alice can assign probabilities to the outcomes of Bob's n measurement, conditional on the states pre and post, in terms of this formula here, which was first proposed in a paper by Aronov, Bergman, and Lebovich in, I think, the 60s. But this is just, you simply, this is basically just a generalization of the Born rule, the usual rule. This is just normalization summed up over all I, where PI are the projection operators associated with all the different possible outcomes of the measurement M. If this measurement M is a non-degenerate or maximal observable, then these would just be projection operators on one-dimensional subspaces, but they could be two-dimensional, three-dimensional subspaces. And you get this equation for the probabilities of the outcome K. Now, you can actually use this to set up a Q distribution. So maybe I should move this so that I stand more out of the way. Okay. If M is unknown to Alice, Alice is doing the pre and post, then she can use this rule to assign probabilities to the outcomes of various hypothetical M measurements. So Bob might choose to measure differently. I mean, the protocol might say, well, if you toss a coin, you can measure either M1 or M2 each time. Alice is sending a particle, preparing a particle in pre, sending it to Bob. Bob makes some measurement, stores the result, he sends the particle back to Alice. Alice makes some other measurement and post selects with the state post. And Bob has presumably a choice about what. So the interesting peculiarity of this rule, by contrast with the Born rule, is that it's possible to assign unit probability to the outcomes of a set of mutually non-commuting observables. There's no contradiction or anything with quantum mechanics, because what you're doing is you're given a pre and a post. If you're just given a state pre, then of course you can't assign probability 1 given pre to two non-commuting observables, to the outcomes of measurements of two non-commuting observables. But you can with the pre and a post, because in effect you're saying, this probability refers to something to a number of possible eventualities, only one of which could have occurred. You're saying, if you measured M, then the probability is 1 that you got a certain outcome. But if you measured N, different observable that doesn't commute with M, then the probability is 1 that you got such and such an outcome. Well, only one or other of those actually occurred. So you don't assign probability 1 to M and M. You say, if M it was measured, then I can tell you what the outcome. Okay, so Alice can mean a position to assert a conjunction of a conditional statements of the form. If Bob measured M and the outcome must have been MI and certain P and Bob measured M prime and so on and so forth for a whole bunch of reasons. So Bob could only have measured at most one of these, there's no contradiction. Now, Weidman, Aronov, and Elbert discuss a case of this sort where the outcomes of the measurement of any of sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z of a Spin-Hoff particle can be inferred. So we'll see how this works. Alice prepares the Bell state. up the Z direction. The C stands for channel particle, which is going to say, well, she's going to keep one of these particles. So if you fit in the tangle state, and Alice sends one of the particles, the channel particle, to Bob and keeps the ancilla A. Bob measures either S, Y, or Z on the channel particle, returns it to Alice, and then Alice can be in a position to assert if Bob measured M, the outcome must have been MI, and so on and so forth, where these are spinning in the X, Y, and Z direction. Since Bob can only have measured one of them, there's a prediction. Oh, look at that other stuff. Just kidding. I don't know. That must have doubled my. Okay, so what is this observable that Alice measures? It's by the way, it's, let me try and indicate very simply where this formula comes from. Let's see, what's a simple way of looking at this? Here's a geometric way of looking at it, which is just very general. I mean, how can it be possible to predict with certainty all these values? Suppose this is just a general case, which I think geometrically indicates what's going on. Suppose this is a three-dimensional, suggest this is three orthogonal lines, three-dimensional building space. And suppose you take a state here, which is almost green, which is in this plane, 45 degrees from here and here. So this, these are the three orthogonal directions. Okay? And take a state post, which is in this plane over here. Okay. Now, suppose that you prepare a state tree, and then you measure the observable associated with this three orthogonal, the spaces. And then you measure an observable, another observable, which has this state as one of its eigenvectors. So it's an observable which is, you know, which is associated with, like, a chord like this, you know, three orthogonal lines. So this is the spinal observable is going to be non commuting this observable. So you prepare the state, that's step one. Step two, you measure this observable, call this observable M. Step three, you measure another observable of which this is one of the eigenstates. And you throw away all the results, you do it over and over again, and you keep only the results for which you got the post. Right? So maybe you throw away two thirds or something of your outcomes, just the relatives, the post of the post. Now, in that case, in those situations, it's easy to see that the outcome of the M measurement in the middle must have been this value here, and not this value in this value. Why? Because if you prepared the state pre, then you could have gotten this, or you could have gotten this, probably wrong. But if you get this, there's no way you can get this, because this state is orthogonal to this plane. So you know that if you got this and you started here, you ended here, then that must have been the outcome in the middle. Right? So this explains why you can infer, if you know pre and you know post, and you know that M was measured in the middle, that must be that result of certainty. Okay? But now if you think about it, and here consider this line and this line. Now that I want to show you that there are a whole infinite set of n's, prime and double prime, all of which you can assign the precise value to. So I'm just going to show you this geometrically. But if you consider this line and this line, although this is in this plane here, and this is in an orthogonal plane here, the angle between this state and this state, not 90 degrees, you can actually just, I don't know, you can see it or you can figure out a little proof. But if I have a line like this, and I draw a line over here at 45 degrees and here at 45 degrees, and the angle between this line and this line is actually going to be 60 degrees. It's you can see by sort of symmetry argument or figure that. Okay, so this angle is actually 60 degrees between 45 here and 45 here. I'll leave that to you as a little geometrical exercise in Euclidean geometry. So this is 60 degrees. Now, it's not hard to see, I don't know, maybe you can visualize this, if you imagine this thing here as a, imagine if you go to the corner of the room, because this is, you've got this three planes here, the floor and the two walls, and you take a wedge of cardboard, and you stick it away to a 60 degree angle, and you stick it in here so that one line is up here and the other line is up here. Then you can try it, if you like. I mean, there's a practical geometry. You can rotate this piece of cardboard in such a way that this line stays in this line, and this line stays in this plane, and this line stays in this plane. And you can slide it. So this will, say, move down, and this will move this way. And if you do it this way, then you'll move this thing all the way up to here, and this line will end up with a 60 degrees angle in this plane. But you can move this wedge in such a way that you keep this line in this plane, touching this plane, and this line in this plane. Okay. Now, if you then move it to some other position where it's not 45 degrees or 45 degrees here, still this thing's in this plane and this thing's in this plane, then if you started off with that tree and that post, it would still sound probably wrong to this. Because, if you're here somewhere and you end up here, then there's no way you're going to end up this plane, because this line is orthogonal to this. So the fact that this is 45 degrees, this 45 degrees, is irrelevant to the conclusion that the middle measurement must have resulted here. In fact, at this thing here, just at this here, and at this here, or something. Same, the only way you can get this in the middle is if this projects first on here, and then on there. Okay. Now, this is the point. Because you can rotate this, and you don't change, you get a different tree into a different post. Rotating this wedge here, if you like, is equivalent to keeping the wedge fixed and rotating the three planes. If you rotate the three lines to a new position, then you've chosen a new observable. So there's an infinite set of observables as you rotate, and you keep this and this in these two planes, for all of which you can infer that you must have gotten this value in the middle. So this is just a geometrical example about how without looking at the formula and calculating, if you use a formula and calculate, then you can work the thing out. But you don't even have to look at the formula, because the formula is just based on, the formula is just going to, as it were, give you what you can see geometrically. And geometrically, what you're saying is, if I start with this state and I end with this state, then I can infer that if the measurement is made in the middle, that for a certain set of observables, then it's all about certain values. The formula is more general. It says if you measured something else, then it must have been, then a certain probability between zero is assigned to certain outcomes. Because if you measure this in the middle, the probability of this is one, so the probability of this is zero, and the probability of this is zero. But there are observables where they'll have different problems. Okay, so that's how you can get it. But now, so what's this idea here? Well, you measure the free state, which is this Bell state. Alpha pairs of Bell state. That's the free state. She sends one particle to bar that keeps the answer.
Bob measures sigma x, sigma y, or sigma z, spinning one of three orthogonal directions random. Sends the ancillary particle back, the channel particle, sorry, to Alice. Alice then makes a measurement in numbers. Alice then has two particles. So there's a four-dimensional orbit space associated with two spin-off particles. And Alice measures some observable R, or a pair of particles, where R has these complicated eigenstates. One over root 2 up in the z direction, you know, plus, and then it's up down with a phase, and down up with a phase. And these are all orthogonal. So R1, R2, R3, and R4. So she gets one of four out. Now, pre was this state here, which can also be written as this state, up, up in the x direction, down, down in the x direction, and can also be written as up, y, down, y, plus down, y, up, y. And it can also be written as R1 plus R2 plus R3 plus R4, if you just write all that out. So Alice can now assign values to the outcomes of Bob measurements by that ABL rule based on the post selections R1, R2, R3, or R4. That means if you got R1, then the post selected state is R1. And then she can make an inference using that formula to what the outcomes of Bob's measurements for sigma x, sigma y, sigma z are. And if you work all that out, you find out that if she got R1, then she knows that these outcomes must all have been 0. If she got R2, then she knows that this must have been 1, and this must have been 1, and this must have been 0, and so on. And so that you get from the formula. And now you can use that as a key distribution protocol. You know, you prepare these states, Bob measures x or z, right? Not y, just x, because we don't need y. I mean, you could choose y, but it's enough for x or z. So he measures x or z randomly, sends the particle back to Alice. Alice then measures the observable R, and she divides the sequence into two subsequences. The subsequence 1-4 for what she got R1, which she got R1 or R4, and the subsequence 2-3 for which she got the outcomes 2 or 3. And now, to check that the channel particles have not been monitored by Eve, she publicly announces all the indices of the subsequence 2-3. Right, making she's going to make alternates. She's measuring this. She's getting all these particles back from Bob. So this one, and she measures R on all this, right? And so here she gets R1, here she gets R2, here she gets R1 again, here she gets R4, and so on. And so then she divides them up into two sequences, the sequences where she gets 1 and 2, so these go into 1 and 2, so this is particle number 1, particle number 2 in the sequence. And if somewhere down here, let's say number 6, she gets an R2. And then here she gets, so this is 3, number 3 she got a, it was 2, 3, and 1, 4, she got a 1, and then number 4 she got a 1, and so on. So she announces the sequences for which she got 2 and 3. I think I got 2 and, I said 1 and 2 and so it has to be 2 and 3, so this is 2, and it's 3 again. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so this is 5. Okay, so this is the sequence for which you go 2 or 3, you know, 5 or 2, 5 or 5, and so on. And then, for this sequence,
she could make conditional statements of the form for channel particle I, if X was measured, the outcome was 1, and if it was measured, and so on. Let's just take a look at that table. She's talking about X and Z. So the sequence for which you got 2 and 3, she can say, if you measured X, if you measured sigma X, then you've got 1. And this is 2 and 3. Got some 1 and 4, which you check that the channel part is not being monitored. She publicly announces 2 and 3. She can make conditional particles. If X was measured and the outcome is 1, and if Z was measured, the outcome is 0. She could say if X was measured, the outcome was 1, because I must have mixed this up, because for 2 and 4 she can do this. And let's see, how does this go? For 2 and 4, she could say if X was measured, the outcome was 1. And that's not right. 2 and 4, this was 1. And 2 and 4 here.
No, but she knows for 2 and 3, so she knows part 2 and part 3. So she can say
from that. Oh, that's right. That's right. Quite right. It's not that she doesn't know whether she got R2 or R3. She knows she got R2. So she knows what she got. So she can say if you measured, so in the R2 cases, she could say if you measured X, you got 1. And if you measured Z, you got 0. You know, each of these, she can say if you measured X, you got a particular value, and if you got Z, you got the opposite. Because you know, for 2 and 3, X and Z have opposite values. 1 and 0, 0 and 1, that's right. And she publicly announces these statements, and if one of these statements...
The 0 and 1 in those things are spin up and spin down.
Yeah, spin up and spin down. So, now, if just one of these statements is wrong, then Bob doesn't have to do any statistics. I mean, if just one of these statements is wrong, then... Eve must have monitored the I's channel, because they have to agree. Now, if they agree, that doesn't mean that the particle is not monitored, because the particle could have been changed, they could have made measurements, and just by fluke gotten the right result. And for suppose Eve measures a different spin component, and Bob measured, and Alice gets one of these values, then Bob's measurement outcome, either 0 or 1, will be compatible with just one of these eigenvalues, assuming no intervention by Eve. But after Eve measured, both of these eigenvalues will be possible outcomes of Alice's measurements. So if Alice gets the outcome, which is not the outcome that she expects, that she knows as being some effort. So Alice's retradictions won't necessarily correspond to Bob records, and you can actually show that if Eve measures X or Z randomly on the channel particles, because she doesn't know what Bob is measuring, or if she measures a particular one of the observables, X, Y, or Z on the channel particle, same observable on the particle, the probability of detection in the subsequence is 3/8. There's quite a high probability that she'll be found out. Even a single disagreement between Alice's repetitions and Bob's record is sufficient to reveal that the channel particles are being monitored. It's the back difference from the test by Eckert. So Eve only has access to the channel particles, not the particle pairs. So no strategy is possible in which Eve replaces all the channel particles with her own particles and entangles the original channel particles with some ancilla or something. So there's no way that Eve can ensure agreement between Alice and Bob without having access to the particle pairs, or without information about Bob's measurements. So she has no information about Bob's measurements, and she does not have access to the particle pairs, so she can't get required information. Now that solves a key distribution problem, but not a key storage problem.
if Bob actually makes the random choices, measures X or Z, and records definite outcomes before Alice measures R, and that's what he's supposed to do, Bob's measurement record stored as classical information in his lab could in principle be copied by me without detection. I mean, if you just got this piece of paper with all these measurement results on it, I mean, that's different than saying that Eve is sort of in the middle somewhere monitoring the particle, and she knows Bob is going to make an X or Z measurement, but she has no access to the measurement that he's actually making or going to make on each particle. But I mean, if Bob actually stores all this stuff and puts it in his safe until Alice makes her measurements and then they have to kind of check and so on, well, then we don't suppose that that's the truth. So if you copy this, then she'd know the raw key containing this information after the public communication as well. So to solve the key storage problem with this protocol, you modify the protocol in the following way. Instead of actually making the random choice for each channel particle, measuring one of the spin observables and recording the outcome, Bob keeps all these random choices and spin measurements at the quantum level, so to speak, until after Alice announces the indices. So now how does he do this? Well, he takes a channel particle and entangles it with the states of two ancillary particles. One particle is he has to do two things. And this actually is a general thing that which comes up in the thing, which I want to talk about then. So we're talking about this. So Bob has to do two things. He has to toss a coin to decide whether to, you know, make some random choice, to decide whether to measure sigma x or sigma z. And then he actually has to make the measurement and get the outcome. So he has to get two definite outcomes, the outcome of the coin toss, you know, heads or tails, and by making a measurement, you know, up or down for sigma x or sigma z. So he has to make a choice which chooses x or z, that's one choice, and secondly, he has to make a measurement result which makes a choice for him, you know, up or down. Now, both of those things he can keep in, keep it entangled, which is what I mean by keep at the quantum level. Instead of actually doing the measurement and getting the outcome, which is something classical written on a piece of paper, you can keep things entangled until the last minute, you know, which is when they make the actual communications. I mean, when Alice actually makes the measurements. And now Alice's measurement outcomes are useless to anybody without knowing what Bob's outcomes are. They're just R1 and R2, you know, so what does that tell you? They have to be correlated with Bob's measurement outcomes, but if Bob actually hasn't made any measurement outcomes, there's nothing to correlate to. So the idea is that he's only going to make these measurements when he does the communication with Alice, not before, so there's no pre-copying. So what he does is, for these two different choices, one choice is like toss a die, you know, or toss a coin. So I'm going to associate that with two eigenstates, you know, D, X, and DZ, because the one choice is associated with spin X, and the other with spin Z. The other particle is associated with the two eigenstates, up and down, point. Okay, so now what does he do? Well, I just mentioned that before Alice announces the indices of this 2-3, neither Alice nor Bob have stored any classical information, so there's nothing to copy. How did he do that? Yeah, I don't actually have this here. I must have missed out the transparency. What he does is he does this. He performs a unitary transformation with one of these in it's got two syllabogrammets, there's a double explanation. And I actually must have it explicit for the literature. But it's something like this. The channel particle that comes in is a particle which is associated with a two-dimensional Brillouin space. And so let's consider that in fact the channel particle is going to be entangled with Alice's particle, like in the, and she prepares, you know, what was it? It was however two sort of, you know, zero z and zero z plus one z one z, you know, which is up and down if it's either. So now the new transformation that Bob performs is it's zero for the channel particle. Zero, some base state, goes to zero. So this is the channel particle, and this is Bob's and Silla particle B. So this goes to zero, zero, and one, zero. Goes to one, one. And so if you have a unitary transform, a linear superposition, or even if it's entangled like this, you know, you would just go to this particular case, the unitary transform take unitary transformation would take you to 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. And then the other one similarly.
And so now, basically what he does is he has two unitary transformations. One that does it for
the pointer, the symbol point. One does it for
the x direction, and one for the z direction.
No, one does one is just entangling. What Paul wants to do is to I call these things something else. All this. Sorry, you're right. Yeah, this was die x to die z. Yeah. That's right. So that's what. So these are two orthogonal states, which are associated with Bob's choice of x or z measures. So all that he does is, if this thing comes in, then this thing evolves to this state, this thing comes in, this thing evolves
to this state. I mean, there's no choice.
There's no choice, yes. But in the end, Bob is actually going to make a measurement of the observable associated with these two eigenstates and actually get one or get the other. So in other words, what Bob is supposed to do is to toss a classical eigenstate and decide whether to measure x or z. Instead, he makes an entanglement like this, and in the end, he makes a measurement of this observable, and he's going to get one of these results with probability off. And then he says, okay, you know, that's the measurement I'm going to make. So I mean, I'm sure I have this thing explicitly C. Should have it explicitly shortly. Yes, here it is. Okay, so let me just say, it's unitary transformation like this. This is similar. In this particular case,
so he makes this choice. He makes the choice of one unitary transformation or another.
No, there are two unitary transformations. One associated with when he has to, in this particular case, he has to make a choice between x and y measurements. So he makes two unitary transformations and he puts them together this way. You see, ux goes like this. So this is very similar. The idea here is, in the Vitkin-Mitkin protocol, he has to make a choice between two measurements, x and y, and he has to make that on the basis of tossing a coin, that's it. So instead of tossing a coin, he associates the coin toss with the unity transformation associated with two state sets of Y, and then the whole transformation looks like this. I think I put it over here. So you know this is the input state, and he starts out with this. This is his sort of die states, which are going to go to dx and dy, and this is the pointer state here. So you know he makes this transformation here, and let's see. Yeah, that's right. That's what I want to get. So you've got the dx is going to be associated with the ux transformation and the dy with the other ux transformation, and so you have here you end up with a linear superposition of dx, which is the one ancillary particle, associated with the unitary transformation ux, linearly superposed with dy and unitary transformation uy. So I mean, ux is some transformation defined on the input state with the ancilla p0. And this transformation here is going to be this. You have the ancilla particle p0 for Bob. This is the channel particle. And you make this unity transformation here, so you can go like this. Psi x1, then x1, p1, psi, it's the scalar product of psi x2, x2, p2, and for y, similarly with y. But now, these are two different unity transformations. What you do is you make a unitary transformation V on an ancilla particle D0 and with the input state and the ancilla particle P0, where you go to this particular state here where dx is associated with this region. So if you write the whole thing out, then what you would write is dx tensor product. And then this state here would be this whole state here, you know, and similarly for u1. So I mean, this thing here is fairly complicated when you write the whole thing out, you know, because it's a double unitary transformation. It's the V unitary transformation for tossing associated with tossing the die. And the U unitary transformation, which is making an X measurement, or which corresponds to an X measurement or a Y measurement. So it's the same thing over here, you know, because here you did two different transformations. One is like tossing a die, and the other one is making one of two measurements. Okay, so let's just go back. So anyway, when they wish to establish a random key, so before Bob has made this entanglement, and when they wish to establish a key, Alice makes her measurements, and Bob makes his measurements. He measures the die particle, and he measures the, depending on the outcome of that, he measures sigma x or sigma y, and he makes the measurement. And then they compare the outcomes. Now you can show that ABL rule applies whether or not the after Alice announces the indices of this subsequence 2, 3, Bob measures B and P and his ancillas and announces the IW. So suddenly then he does that. And then if they decide there's been no eavesdropping, then he measures and P on the subsequence 1, 4, and use that as the key. The ABL rule applies in this case, but we can see that quite easily. And in fact, if the two cases were not equivalent, the two cases are, one, Bob actually makes the measurements and writes down the numbers and then sends the particle to the grounds. The other case is Bob doesn't make any measurements. He does the entanglement. And then Alice makes her measurements and then he makes these measurements. Okay. Now, if Alice could actually tell the difference between whether Bob actually made the measurements or performed the entanglement, which is effectively making the measurements at the quantum level, but not really, you know, recording it, just making an entanglement. But if Alice could tell the difference, then you'd be able to signal superluminally, because Alice would know whether or not it's nameless that he had made a measurement. So the two cases have to be equivalent. Alice could tell from her R measurements whether Bob actually made the random choice and actually performed the spin measurements, or had really implemented these things at the quantum level, the difference could be used to signal superluminal. And that's actually the whole trick, as it were, which underlies the impossibility of secure decommitment protocol, as we'll see. It's the impossibility of actually knowing that somebody really made a measurement. Because if somebody really made a measurement, then you'd be able to implement if you knew that secure decommitment. Okay, so let's move to bit decommitment. That's why I did the other stuff, because you can use pre and post selection for secure key distribution, and you might think that you might be able to use it for a secure bit commitment, but in fact you can't, because the situation is different, as we'll see. So let's take a look at this. First of all, in a bit commitment party protocol, one party supplies an encrypted bit to a sacred copy. The information available in this encrypted bit should be sufficient for Bob, should be insufficient for Bob to tell what Alice's choice was. But it should be sufficient when Alice supplies Bob with further information at a subsequent stage, called the opening stage, when she reveals the value of the bid, for Bob to be convinced that the protocol will allow Alice to cheat by encrypting the bid that leaves it free to be reliable at 0-1. Well, so the idea is there a protocol where Alice can make a choice, send something to Bob, like, you know, a piece of paper with 0-1 written on it, and it's safe, where Bob cannot know what the choice was, but be assured that she didn't cheat, she didn't change her mind at the last minute, and then a week later or something, she can, she's supposed to reveal her choice, and then he opens the box and he sees that actually she told the truth. Can you do this by some encryption method? If you can do this by some encryption method, then, I mean, you can imagine various kind of games. I mean, suppose, which like this might be relevant to, I mean, I said something about gambling on the internet last time, but suppose that Alice claims the ability to, she has some kind of ability to predict the stock market or something, and she doesn't have any money to invest, and so she comes to you because you have lots of money. And she says she has this ability. Well, if you're not going to pay her unless she can prove that she has the ability. Well, how can she prove that she has the ability without revealing it? She could say, well, you know, I predict that this is in stock before tomorrow, and then, you know, you just bet on it. You win, and then you don't pay us anything. So how can she prove to you that she has this ability without you being able to exploit it first? And you can imagine that you know, two multinational companies want to enter into some kind of cooperative agreement, but they have certain, they each have a certain amount of resources, but they don't want to reveal to the other party exactly what they have, and so they want to essentially compute a function which does not, where the outcome of the function does not actually enable either party to know more than a certain amount about the other party. I'll give you a precise example in a second. Just to go back to bit commitment, I mean, suppose Alice says, look, I have this ability. One way of proving it would be to actually make the choice about which stock is going to go up, and not write it on a piece of paper and hand you a save because you can open the save. But get involved in a risk commitment protocol where you have some information that you can't disentangle, you can't actually open it up to see what there is. And then after the stock rises, she says, you see, I predicted this would go up. And then you take a look at your encrypted information, and she supplies you with the key, some further information, and you can see that actually she did predict this stock. The other thing that I was saying about multinational vendoring into cooperative arrangement, I mean, it's sort of an example of what's sometimes called the dating problem. I mean, suppose Alison Bob, want to go out on a date together, but they don't want to reveal to each other. They only want to go out on a date if they both like each other. It would be very embarrassing for Alice if she agrees that she likes, if she makes it clear that she likes Bob, but actually Bob doesn't like Alice, and so then they don't go out on a date. But then Alice has revealed, you know, the fact that she likes Bob, and Bob has lost nothing because he didn't like Alice. So what you want is for Alice and Bob to actually compute a function together, where the result is one. And if the result is one, they go out on a date. If it's zero, they don't go out on a date. But where the output is only one, if Alice equals one and Bob equals one. So they're only going to go out of date if they both like each other. But if the value of a function is zero, then it shouldn't be the case that, you're going to get a zero if Alice is equal to zero and Bob is equal to zero, or if Alice is equal to one, Bob is equal to zero, or if Alice is equal to zero, and Bob is equal to one. All these cases, they won't go out of date. They would like to compute where they only go out on a date if they both like each other, but if they both hate each other, then no, and if one or other hates each other, then okay. But if you end up with a zero, it must be the case that if Bob was actually, but Bob knows that he has gave the value zero, but he doesn't know that Alice had value one, because it could have been zero. So although Alice knows if the outcome is zero, then Bob didn't like her and she liked Bob, this is sort of Alice's private pain. it's not made public and embarrassing. So if you can do good commitment, then you can do things like this. And this whole situation might be actually a big multinational where they each have certain resources that they don't want to reveal to the other, but they would like to enter into a cooperative agreement if they both compute a function correct to this particular value set. But if it doesn't work out, then they haven't revealed more information that is required to actually, that is associated with this value zero. The value zero, then they know things didn't work out for some reason, but they don't know what the reason is. So anyway, all these kinds of things are associated with the different cryptographic protocols, and if bit commitment is possible, then you can do a lot of these things. And if it's not possible, well, then maybe you can't. So let's take a look at this. Now, classically, you can't do this because Alice can send encrypted information to Bob that guarantees the truth of an exclusive classical disjunction, which is equivalent to either zero or one, exclusively. Only if this information is actually biased towards one of the alternative disjuncts. Because a classical exclusive disjunction is true if and only one of these things is true or the other false. So the information must be associated with either the zero or the one. It's classical information. And even if it's very complicatedly entangled there is some difference between the encrypted information associated with zero and the encrypted information associated with one. So in principle, Bob can extract this information. He says no principle of classical physics which precludes Bob from extracting this information, so security can only be a matter of computational complexity. The question was whether there's a quantum analog of this which is secured by the laws of physics against cheating by either Alice or Bob. Bob can cheat if he can obtain some information about Alice's commitment before she reveals it, which would give him advantage in repetitions of the protocol. So even though, it's important to define what you mean by cheating. You only have Alice and Bob, and there's no Eve in this situation. But Alice and Bob don't trust each other, whereas with a key distribution protocol, Alice and Bob do trust each other. But there's going to be an Eve who's probably who they don't trust. Okay. I mean, this is sometimes referred to with commitment as post-Cold War cryptography, because in pre-Cold War cryptography, the classic kind of cryptographic situation was you've got two or more parties who trust each other because they're on the same side, and then you have some outsider that they don't trust. But in post-Cold War cryptography, nobody trusts anybody anymore, so you have protocols like, you know, Alice and Bob trying to do something cooperatively, but they don't trust each other. So the cryptographic protocols are designed to see how they can cooperate together. So there's like authentication. Do you trust that person is actually who they say they are? And so then, you know, there's just complete distrust of how can you work. It's a different kind of game. You know, either you have some parties trust each other and they worry about third party, or nobody trusts each other and can you get something there. Okay, so Bob can cheat if he can obtain some information about Alice's commitment. You know, just that the probability is that it's a zero. So even though that might not help him on this game, if they have a bit commitment protocol over and over and over again, then you can get an advantage. So that counts as cheating. Alice can cheat if she can delay actually making a commitment. If she's going to be committed until the final stage when she's required to reveal her commitment, or if she can change her commitment at the final stage with a very low probability of detection. So this was originally thought to work out quantum mechanically. Bennett and Broussard proposed a quantum commitment protocol in 1984, and the basic idea was to associate these 0 and 1 commitments with two different mixtures. So the idea is if Alice moves to zero, she sends Bob a 50-50 mixture of spin up and down in the x direction. If she commits to one, up and down in some other direction, the z direction, Bob can't tell the difference because what he has is just a mixture associated with half the identity. The two mixtures are absolutely equivalent in terms of any measurements he might make. But Alice knows that particle number one, she prepared up x, particle number two, you know, also up x direction, particle number three, down x direction, and so on. So afterwards, she can tell him, if you measure particle number one in the x direction, you're going to get up. And if you measure particle number two, if you measure all these particles in the x direction, then you're going to get up or down. I'll tell you before you do whether you get up or down. And that then is supposed to confirm her commitment, because she wouldn't be able, if she actually sent particles in the x direction, spin up and down in the x direction, then she can't predict. She's going to be completely random and probably half about predicting outcomes of z direction measurements, right? I mean, so if she commits to zero, she sends it spin up and down in the x direction, and then she, halfway along, she decides, oh my god, I should have changed my mind. I mean, the stock market is, you know, changing. I should have said Z. I should have said one, not zero. And at the last minute, she tries to pretend that she actually said up or down in Z direction. He's got all these up or down in the X direction. Then she's going to not be able to predict. She's not going to be able to pretend that she actually sent him up or down in Z direction, because she won't be able to predict the outcomes of these measures. If she's telling a measure in Z direction, I'll predict the outcomes. There'll be a chance. Okay, so this looks like it will work. You know, you send a mixture, you send one or two mixtures, they're equivalent, Bob can't tell the difference. But Alice can convince him afterwards that the mixture is a particular mixture. But as Broussard showed, Alice can cheat by adopting what they call an EPR attack, or a cheating strategy. She doesn't do what she's supposed to do, send the X or Z mixtures. She just prepares lots of entangled pairs and keeps one. and she prepares them in one of the bell states. And she sends the second qubit to Bob. And in this way, she can fake sending one or two equivalent pictures, because what she does is she just makes up her mind at the opening stage. And then she says, I chose one, and look, I'll prove it to you by telling you the outcomes of X measurements, spin up in X direction, down in X direction. So she measures then, at the last minute, on her particle, spin in the X direction, if she wants to do that. And she gets an answer, and then she just tells Bob what his outcome is, because his outcomes have to be oppositely correlated, so if it's the if she sent in the state root 2, 0, 1, -1, 0, if that's the state that she sent in.
But she can't determine the outcome. Like, she can know what the outcome is.
No, I know, but she can't, if she knows, but that's all, because what Bob has got, what Bob thinks he's got, is a big bag of particles, so they label, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, right? Just in the order in which he received it. And he thinks that they are all up or down in the X direction, or down in the X direction. He thinks they are, but there's no way he can tell. I mean, or it's up or down in the Z direction, down. So he thinks that this bag of particles, which are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, are all up or down in this direction, or up or down in this direction. Right? Now, what else? They're not, because they are, depending on how you want to look at it. I mean, it's true that they're up or down in the X direction, but also up or down in the Z direction. Because in fact, what he's got is, one half of an entangled state. So what Alice does, so Alice hasn't, all that Alice has prepared is exactly the same state, this thing here, every single pair. And then at the opening stage, she just, this is particle 3 and so on. She just says, let's say this is associated with the 0 commitment, and this is associated with the 1 commitment. She decides at the last minute. She has not made a commitment before. She decides at the last minute she's going to choose 1. So she says, a week ago, I committed to 1. Bob says, well, prove it to me. Proving means I'm going to measure sigma. If you're committed to up, if you're committed to 1, that means I will make a measurement in the Z direction. So he'll get plus up, down, up, down, up, down, and so on in the Z direction. And what she has to do is to predict these results and tell you what all these results are. Well, she can obviously do this just by measuring her particles in the Z direction, but it's going to get all the same as well. So that's not going to work. She could fake sending 1 or 2 equivalent pictures to Bob and reveal either bit of wool at the opening stage by effectively steering Bob's particle into the desired mixture. If you remember this Schrodinger's steering, by making this measurement here, she, in effect, as Schrodinger said, steers this system into up or down in the X direction, or, depending on her measurement, up or down in the Z direction. That's what Schrodinger found alarming and called steering. Okay, so there was various people find various mid-commitment protocols, and eventually Myers, M-A-Y-E-R-S, and Lo and Chow, sort of simultaneously, Lo, who is visiting here now from Toronto, proved that there's no way of doing this. In fact, they proved that this EPR strategy can be generalized, there's just nothing that will do. Now, I mean, at first sight, this is actually remarkable, because Toronto, it was the initial idea, okay, you send 1 or 2 mixtures, and then you see, well, that's not going to work, because you can from the Karen Kagan states. But how do you know that nothing is going to work? I mean, maybe there's some protocol involving pre and post selection or something, who knows, that would work. But there is a theorem which proves that nothing will work. And it's remarkable that you use a simple theorem that you could really show that nothing's going to work. First time when you see the theorem, then you think, well, but that doesn't Yeah, it's supposed to consider every possible conceivable protocol, and it doesn't sort of run through a list, obviously. It's a general proof, and you have to see why it's going to work in every single case. So here's the crucial insight. Crucial insight is that any step in a quantum bit commitment protocol, because you can imagine a protocol might involve, you know, Alice preparing something, sending particles to Bob, and it needs to stop there. Maybe Bob has to do something, send it back to Alice, and Alice do something, send it back to Bob. So there could be various steps back and forth until you stop and say, okay, now that's established the commitment. So any step is going to, any step that requires one or other party to make a different choice, for example, to perform one of a number of alternative measurements, or to implement one of a number of unitary transformations, or to do anything like that. You can always replace any such step by an EPR cheating strategy in a generalized sense, where that means have an ancilla and perform an entanglement in the way that I, you know, suggested before. So if you have any two possibilities, do this or that, measure this or that, make it this or that energy transformation, but that's a definite thing. It has to be this or that. And that's like a classical disjunction over definite possibilities, this operation or that operation. You can always replace it by a quantum entanglement and a subsequent measure. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to make the choice. But you can delay the choice. And so that neither possibility is definite until the end. Now, it turns out that if you do that, then the protocol can't be secure. So, you know, you can perform one of two operations, or you can keep a measurement at the quantum level instead of performing the measurement and getting a definite outcome, you can make a suitable unitary transformation on an enlarged orbit space, you know, where you entangle the system with what you might call a pointer ancilla, which are going to be the possible states of the ancilla that would be associated with the measurement outcomes, and you delay. And so the key point is the possibility of keeping all these transactions between Alice and Bob at the quantum level by logic open space with ancillas until the final exchange of information. So any bit commitment scheme will involve a series of back and forth transactions and various operations, and you can just replace them by these entanglements. So here's the illustrates. I'm just going to do this again that I did before, but now I'll sort of go a little carefully over. Suppose that at a certain stage, Bob's required to make a random choice between measuring one of two observables, X or Y, on each channel particle he receives from Alice. Suppose X and Y have two eigenvalues, so each X1, X2, Y1, and Y2. And then suppose Bob is supposed to record the outcome of his measurement. So it's going to be the next one or one, two, and return the channel particle to Alice. So he's not supposed to give her the outcome of the measurement, but he keeps that. It's part of the protocol. And when Alice receives the eighth particle, she sends Bob the next particle. So suppose he's supposed to do that. And this is just part of the protocol. Now, I can say, instead of following the protocol, he can construct a device that entangles the input state of the channel particle with two states, calling them D0B and P0B. And D0B is going to have two states, it's going to be in two-dimensional orbit space associated with the choice, and P0 is going to be associated with the measurement outcome. So one I'm thinking of is a quantum guide, and that's why it's D, or quantum coin, I could say, for the random choice, and the other one is P for measurement pointer. Now, we assume that Bob has unrestricted ability to do these unitary transformations. And here's how it's implemented. I mean, the two X and Y measurements are implemented by unitary transformations X and Y. Like this. So if the input state is x1 and the pointer particle is in some ready state p0, then you're going to go to x1, p1. And if this is x2, x prime and x2 are the two eigenstates of x, then the ready state is going to go to point 2. And similarly for y. And that means that if you have some state which is a linear superposition of x and y, of x1 and x2, then you start, you know, this unity transformation is going to take you to a linear superposition of the two pointer states with x1 associated with p1 and some coefficient, and x2, p2, some coefficients. The coefficients come from some. And similarly for y. And now the random choice is defined similarly by unitary transformation on the tensor product of the open space box particle and the channel particle. So these are going to be two orthogonal states in Bob's filtered space, such that d0 is 1 over root 2 dx, 1 over root 2 dy, where dx and dy are associated with the choice of x and y measurement. So the unitary transformation V is going to be defined this way, dx with psi and p0 is going to be dx, the unitary transformation x, p0, py, and so on. So that if you have, instead of, so that if you start off with d0, which is a linear superposition of dx and dy, then you're going to end up with that. And now, if Bob were to actually choose the observable x or y and actually perform the measurement and get a particular eigenvalue, then Alice's density operator for the channel particle would be this. It would be half, and this is this coefficient from psi, half projection of x1, half this, which is a mixture of x1 and x2 plus half a mixture of y1 and y2, because Bob is choosing to measure x1 50% of the time and y1 50% of the time, and he's going to get x1 with this probability if there's the channel particle of psi, the particle Hal sends it, and with this probability if x2, and similarly, you know, these are the probabilities for getting y. So this is the mixture that Alice gets back if Bob actually makes the measure. So you see, Bob actually makes the measure and sends the particle to y. What Alice knows is Bob measured x or y randomly, probably half, and he got some one or other outcome, you know, either x1, x2, or y1, and y2. So the particle that I have must be in a mixture of all these possibilities. Assuming Alice doesn't know what observable Bob measured, nor what outcome it is. It's a mixture of two measurements and two outcomes each measurement. But that's exactly the same density operator generated by tracing over Bob's ancilla particles. See, Bob did not actually make the measure, make the choice, x or y, and make the measure, get x1 or y1 or y2 or so. But he did these entanglements with ancillas, and then the final state of the particle is not this mixture, but it's this state. 1 over root 2, you know, x, ux, psi, p0, so that it's a psi is entangled with dx and p0 by this final state. So it's not that Bob sends Alice particles which are in this mixture, he sends Alice particles which are in this pure state, every single one exactly the same pure state. But if Alice traces over the dye particles, because she doesn't have the dye particle in these ancillas, Alice does not have this particle in her possession or this particle. Bob just sends it back aside. So if Alice traces over this Hilbert space and this Hilbert space, then she just gets back. In other words, the density operator for the channel particle is the same for Alice, whether Bob randomly chooses which observer to measure and actually performs a measurement, or whether he implements an EPR cheating strategy that produces this final state on the enlarged open space with these two ancilla particles. And if Bob is required to eventually report, as part of the protocol, what measurement he performed and what outcome he obtained,
at the end of the day, then he can at that stage measure his guide particle and his pointer particle to get the, you know, Vx and Vy or P1 and P2. In effect, when he does that, he will have converted the improper mixture that Alice has in her hands into a proper mixture by making these measurements. But the difference between these two situations, where he actually makes a measurement or he keeps the sense of entangled particle, that must be undetectable to Alice. So she has no access to bolts and solids, and it's only by measuring the composite system consisting of the channel particle together with bolts and solids that she could tell that particle is entangled with bolts and solids. In fact, if Alice could distinguish between a proper and an improper mixture, if she could, in other words, if she could distinguish whether the bot actually made the measurement or not, then it would be possible to signal superluminally. Alice could know instantaneously whether or not the bot performed the measurement by monitoring, by looking at the channel particles in her possession. And in that way, the bot could signal superluminally. It makes no difference whether Bob or Alice measures first, since the measurements are observables in different orbit spaces, and so they can be. Now, you might say, well, okay, that's interesting, but that's just a special case. What about if Bob has to perform a measurement on the channel particle I plus 1, conditional on the outcome of, what do you think, it's something more complicated, of a prior measurement on the channel particle I, or conditional on a prior choice of some operation from like a set of alternative operation. But if Bob is in possession of all the channel particles at the same time, he can perform entanglement with ancillas on the entire sequence, taking that as an entire system. But suppose he doesn't. Suppose he has to do something to one channel particle, depending on what happened to the previous one, and then return it to Alice before she sets it to the next channel particle. But he can still always entangle the I plus 1 particle with the ancillas he used to entangle the I particle. And he keeps the ancillas, finally has to send the particle back, but then he gets a new particle, and he entangled these ancillas with the previous particle, now he can entangle them with the new particle. So let's see what happens here. Suppose he's presented with two channel, particles in sequence. He's supposed to decide randomly whether to measure X or Y on the first particle, perform the measurement, and return the particle to Alice, so he no longer measures. And after Alice receives the first particle, he sends on the second particle. If Bob measured X on the first particle and got X1, he's supposed to measure X on the second particle. If he got X2, then he's supposed to measure Y. If he measured Y on the first particle, so he has to choose to measure X or Y on the first particle. If he measures Y on the first particle and got Y1, then he's supposed to apply some other unitary transformation to the second particle. And if he's got Y2, he's supposed to. So this is, I think, of something complicated. He gets one particle, he's supposed to measure X or Y. Then he gets another particle, and depending on his outcome, he's supposed to do two very different things. If he measured X, and you've got X1, then he's supposed to measure X on the second particle, and you've got X2, Y. But if he measured Y, then he's supposed to do these unit transformations. And after performing this, he's supposed to return the second particle. So it would seem that he has to actually do all this stuff, given that he has only access to one particle. So it would seem that he can't do this kind of entanglement. But he does the following. I mean, he applies the EPR strategy for two alternative measurements, the one I had before, an X or Y measurement, to the first particle. For the second particle, he applies a certain unity transformation on his, and then so does his God, and on his ancillas and the second channel particle. And I'm denoting the state of the second channel particle by phi and the state of the pointer ancilla by q0. Then here is the rather complicated transition. The unit transformation is defined now he's got two dye particles. He's got three dye particles and phi. And the unity transformation is defined in this way.
I mean, for x and the outcome p1, he does ux. For x and the outcome p2, he does uy. For y and the outcome p1, he does... He's supposed to, if he measured x and got result 1 or 2, he's supposed to measure x or y on the second particle, which is in the state 5. If he measured y and got result 1 or 2, he's supposed to perform a unitary calculation, 1 or 2, on 5. So, in actual fact, he takes another particle, q0, and he does this complicated unitary transformation. And since an EPR strategy can always be applied without detection, the proof assumes that at the end of the condition stage, when she's going to when she's finally when you've completed all the steps that will finally result in a commitment for the opening stage, the composite system consisting of Alice's and Scylla's, the N-channel particles of Bob's and Scylla's, will be represented by some composite state that you can call zero, which is the state that you end up with that is associated with the commitment, zero or one, depending on whether Alice intends to reveal zero or one. Where HA is the Hilbert space of all the particles Alice has got, and HB is the Hilbert space of all the particles that Bob's got. So, I mean, there's a whole series of steps, but at the end of the day, this complicated and entangled state resulting from all these transactions must either be a zero state or a one state. And Alice will, and it's going to be a state in a Hilbert space like this, where Alice has some of these particles, probably some of these particles. Now, the density operators this that Bob has, that characterizes the state that Bob has, are going to be represented in this way. I mean, he has to trace over Alice's particles to get a density operator that characterizes all the particles in his position. If these are the same, then Bob can't distinguish the zero state from the one state. In that case, the protocol is going to be concealed, and Bob can't cheat. What the proof establishes, and it's the bioclinical decomposition theorem that underlies it, is that if these things are the same, then there exists a unitary transformation that will transform 0 to 1. That is, if the protocol is concealing, then it cannot be binding on Alice, because if there's a unitary transformation in Alice's Hilbert space, she can flip 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. So the proof establishes, and I've included it, that if Bob can't cheat because the particles in his position for the zero state, for the zero choice, for one choice, are associated with the same density operator, then there must exist the unitary transformation that Alice can perform that will switch the whole entangled state from a zero to a one. But this zero is the state of the entire entangled composite system held in by Bob and by Alice. So this zero is a state of HA cross HB, but there must exist a unitary transformation in HA alone that will transform this state to this state if these things are the same. That is, if the protocol is concealing, then it can't be binding on Alice. You can always follow the protocol to establish the state zero, and then the final stage, you can reveal what she wants to reveal. So that's a proof. And here's, I think there's something I need to do the proof here quickly. I said it depends on the bioclinical decomposition here. So you can, the proof is very simple. I mean, it's so simple that it's almost puzzling that it can apply to everything. So let me just run through the proof. At the end of the day, after all, whatever kind of complicated entanglements anybody does, the state, there are going to be two states, zero and one. And you can write this down in the Schmidt decomposition in terms of Alice states and Bob states in this way, because the Schmidt decomposition says any state can be written this way. Where these are orthonormal sets of states in HA, and these are orthonormal sets of states in HB. And now the density operators in in Bob's orbit space are just defined by tracing over Alice's orbit space, so you get this or you get that. And Bob can't cheat if and only if these two things are the same. So now by the spectral theorem, these decompositions, if these numbers are all different, that's an undegenerate case. PR all distinct, these all distinct, then this is unique because this is a mixture that's written as a convex combination of pure states, and there's only one way of writing such a mixture. If these things are all unique, I mean, these are all different. Okay? As orthogonal states, you can write it as non orthogonal states, but I mean, as orthogonal states, is one way of writing this down. This condition implies that for all k, these numbers correspond. Pi is equal to Pi prime, and Vi is Pi prime, because of this uniqueness by the spectral theorem. So, since I got it up, I missed that. So, it's going to have to be the same. These P's are the same. These P's have to be the same, one by one. That's what was left out of the game. It follows that there has to be a unitary transformation in Alice's Hilbert space that will just take the A's to the A primes and hence the 0's to the 1's. That's it. I mean, now you might say, well, what about the degenerate case when these P's are not all the same? Well, suppose that P1 is P2 is equal to P1 prime, and P2 prime is P. Then these vectors span some two-dimensional Hilbert space. And so you could write 0 and 1 in this case, say 0, square root of p, a1, b1 plus a2, b2 plus all the rest, and 1 can be written square root of p, these things, plus all the rest. And but you could also write this with respect to different states here in this space, where these are orthonormal states spanning the Hilbert space. Since this one, and all these guys is an orthonormal set in Alice's Hilbert space, this Hilbert space here is just a two-dimensional Hilbert space, subspace of HA. There exists a unity transformation in HA that's going to transform all the AKs, the AKs of these, to these. And so you can transform 0 to 1. So, I mean, the proof is like ridiculously elementary. And you might even be sort of puzzled as to say, well, it's almost like a sleight of hand. How does that prove that every single possible protocol would fail? So, I think here's a way of seeing it, perhaps, in terms of an example. And, I mean, the example will look like it works. And then when you see why it doesn't work, you'll see where the theorem takes it. So I think that's the best way of seeing this. So here's a protocol. And actually this was proposed by Asher Peres, who's a very smart guy, because he thought this would work. Lots of people kept proposing, and I think people still do, probably go to the quantum archives and see protocols that people say, look, I mean, this works, there's something wrong with the theorem. But here's something by Peres. Suppose Alice is required to send Bob a channel particle C in one of these three states. So these are three non-orthogonal states, which are at an angle of 180 degrees. Okay, so you've got the state 0, and then you've got these two other states here. Because these two states are 120, this is 120 degrees and 120 degrees. So you have three states like that. If she commits to 0, and another three states which are at 120 apart, but starting with state 1, so it's this state, Yeah. So she's supposed to send either these three nanoparticle states or these three nanoparticle states. An equal weight mixture of these two. Suppose Alice decides that she's not going to do that, she's going to cheat. So she's in one of these two mixtures. And she's going to prepare this entangled state here. From A1, A2, A4 were. She's got C0, C2, C4. Those were the three states at 120 degrees apart, starting at 0, C1, C3, the hot ones, are starting at 1. So it's those states. So suppose she says, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take an acela particle and prepare this entangled state for 0, 2, 4, and a different state for 1, 3, and 5. Okay. Now, but what she's going to do is she's actually going to prepare this state and send the channel particle above and keep this state. So these states are orthogonal. An orthonormal basis in a three-dimensional Hilbert space of a pseudo-ancilla system, A. And these three orthogonal states are correlated with the three states 120 degrees apart. And what she's going to do is, her idea is that if she prepares this state, sends well the channel particle, then she can cheat because she doesn't actually have to make a choice. She holds the channel particle, and she's just going to make a measurement of this observable associated with this orthonormal basis, or the observable associated with this orthonormal basis, and choose at the last minute by then whether she holds a mixture associated with 0, 2, and 4, or 1, 3, and 5. That's her idea. Now, if she could do that, then she could transform the state 0 to the state 1 by a unitary transformation in her Hilbert space. Then she could delay the commitment to the opening stage. Because if she starts off with this state, and then she makes the unitary transformation at the end of the day, she changes her mind, she'll have this state. So she could then, you know, control, as it were, whether Bob has a mixture of 1, 3, 5 or a mixture of 0, 2, 4 by measuring the observable 0, 2, 4 or 1, 3, 5. But I mean, in order to do that, she would have to be able to flip this to that. So can she do this? Even at that stage, she decides to commit to 0, and then she measures the observable these eigenstates, and if she decides to commit to 1, then she would do that. So can she do that? Well, here's Peres's argument that she can't. And if she can't, he said, well, then how could she cheat? She's supposed to, by the way, these two mixtures, this mixture and this mixture, are both associated with the identity. And so Bob can't tell the difference. So if Alice can actually flip between this one and this one, then she can cheat. So what he wants to show is that Bob can't cheat because the mixtures are the same. And Alice can't cheat because she can't flip between one and the other. So it's secure. It is. So here's his argument that Alice can't cheat. 0 can be written this way. I mean, you just have to see what A24 with C0, C2, C4, but C0 is C3 minus C5 over root 3, and C2 is C1 minus 3 over, these states are just related to these states by these conditions if you just draw them out, write them out. Now you can, so this state here is just the state C0, and this state here is just the state C2, and this is just the state, it was 0, 2, 4, right? And 1, 3, 5. Okay, but now you can rewrite this thing. I mean, just collecting terms, so we get C1, and then that's A2 and minus A4. So let's get this problem. and so on. So this state can be rewritten as this. But in this representation of zero, these factor states, A2 minus A4, A0 minus A2, A4 minus A0, are not orthogonal. Right? I mean, these states, this and this are orthogonal. And this and this are not orthogonal. Because these are the states 1, what's it, 0, 2, 4, C0, C2, C4, which are 120 degrees apart. When you write like this, these states are not orthogonal. In fact, they are coplanar. Because A0 minus A2 can be written as minus A2 minus A4 minus A4 minus A0. So this state is a linear superposition of this state and this state. So they're not orthogonal. In fact, they lie in the same plane. Right? I mean, you can't have three orthogonal states in the same two-dimensional plane. So it seems that there can't be a suitable unitary transformation that will map 0 to 1. Because the state 1 was C1, C3, C5, where these are 120 degrees apart, so 1, 3, and 5 for the A's are orthogonal. So what he wants to show is that you can't flip this state to this state, because if you write that state 0 in this way, then you see that these states here are actually coplanar, so they can't be orthogonal. And so, but here I've written 0 as, C1, C3, C5 with certain states here. So if there is a unitary transformation that will transform 0 to 1, then it would have to be done entirely in Alice's orbit space. So it would have to take this state, this state, this state, to A1, A3, A5. But A1, A3, A5 are orthogonal. So I mean, if you want to flip this to 1, the only difference between this state and 1 is that this term here is A1, and this term here is A2, and this term here is A3. And those A1, A2, A3 are orthogonal. So if you want to flip this to the state 1, you would have to make a unity transformation that transforms this and this and this, which are coplanar, into three orthogonal states, but there can't be such a unitary transformation. So it seems there can't be a suitable unitary transformation that will map 0 to 1 and EPR strategy is blocked. Okay, so now what's wrong? I mean, theorem says you have to be able to have a unitary transformation because the mixtures for Bob are the same. So there must be a unitary transformation in Alice's Hilbert space, which will do the trick. And we've just proved, or seem to have proved, that there's no such unitary transformation. So what's wrong? Well, nothing is wrong. It's just that, and there's sort of an assumption of uniqueness in the thing before, which doesn't apply here. 0 and 1, the theorem says express 0 and 1 in the Schmidt decomposition. So they can always do this. Schmidt decomposition is always a possibility. It's theory. So right here is here I've written that in the Schmidt decomposition. If you write that in the Schmidt decomposition, then you don't get zero. I mean, there's a unique way of writing zero in the Schmidt decomposition. It's 1 over root 2 this C0 plus this C1. The previous formulation of zero was not in the Schmidt decomposition because it had states here which were at 120 degrees apart. The Schmidt decomposition is a decomposition which is unique, which where this and this are orthogonal and this are orthogonal, is bi-orthogonal. So zero turns that turns out to be if you take zero, this turns out to be the Schmidt decomposition. And if you take one, this is the Schmidt decomposition. You have zero and one here and these states here, which are also orthogonal. Now, clearly, there exists a unitary transformation in HA from 0 to 1. Why clearly? Well, these states here are the same. So all you have to do is to flip these two to these two, but these two are orthogonal, and these two are orthogonal. So clearly, I mean, you know, they're just two different orthogonal sets, like this, and like, you know, like this. So clearly there's some unity transformation that will flip the line of play, the state of the state. So clearly you can flip the one to the other by an energy transformation, which means you can flip zero to one by a transformation in analysis of the space alone. Okay, now it follows from the existence of that unity transformation that a 0, a 2, a 4, which are orthogonal in analysis of the space, must go by that unity transformation to some other orthogonal state, call it a 0, 5, right? Where that's some other basis. And so it must be the case, seeing that 0 is expressed as the linear superposition of a 0, a 2, a 4, and some other states, you know, that Bohr holds, C states. It must be this case that when you transform this to this, that 0 goes to 1, you know that's the case. So it must be the case that 1 can be written like this, with a 0 prime, a 2 prime, a 4 prime, correlated with 0, 2, and 4. But we know that 1 can also be written like this, where that's 1, 3, 5 with 1, 3, 5 here. So we know that this must be equal to that for some basis, prime basis. So Alice could implement the CPR strategy by preparing the state 1 and measuring this basis for the zero provision, or that basis. But let's just go back. I mean, if that's really the case, then 1 can be written in terms of 0, 2, 4, which was how we wrote 0 before, but with states without primes. And 1 can also be written in terms of these states. Then there's another way that Alice could implement the tuning predicate. She could just measure it in this basis and create the mixture 1, 3, 5, or measure in this basis and create the mixture 0, 2, 4. Equivalently, I mean, she could compare the state 0 and measure in two different bases, since the energy transformation that takes 1 to 0 also takes the basis 1, 3, 5 to some double prime basis. And so this must be the case. With 0, 2, 4 here and 1, 3, 5 here, just these are problems. And that's what Paris said couldn't be the case, but that proof of this is mistaken. A calculation shows that these double primes can actually be written like that. And so in effect, if Alice prepares the entangled state 0 and measures the ancilla A in this basis, she steers the channel particle, the particle ball cuts into a mixture of non-orthogonal states 0, 2, 4, and if she measures in this basis, then she steers the channel particle into a mixture of non-orthogonal states 1, 5. It follows that Alice can implement that cheating strategy by without performing any unity transformation at all. The theorem says there's always unity transformation, but you don't need the unity transformation. You can just enlarge the channel, entangle the channel particle with a single ancilla particle, and perform one of two measurements at the opening stage, depending on your commitment. So this is completely unsecure. So this shows the unity transformation required by the theorem, in fact, isn't required. I mean, the theorem could actually put more simply. If the cheating strategy is possible, which Alice, at the opening stage, either makes a measurement of an entangled state for the zero predictor, or transforms this to a different state by a local unity transformation in vertical space, and then makes a measurement of transform state, then an equally good cheating strategy is available in cheating, which you just prepare one entangled state and make two different measurements basis. Okay, well that was, so that's a bit of a theorem. As I mentioned, you know, a lot of people have tried various ways of getting around it, but if you think about the theorem in terms of this example and realize that any determinate choice, I mean, any choice of some definite thing, like a Dallas or Bob, as opposed to perform measurement or opposed to perform an operation of some sort, can always be delayed by this entanglement procedure where things are kept at the quantum level. Then at the end of the day, there's just going to be one big entangled state, which is either a zero state or a one state. And then the theorem says that if the density operators for Bob are the same for the zero choice and the one choice, there must be a unitary transformation in our system of the space, which will flip the one complicated state, however complicated it is, to the other state. So if you take a look, if you were interested, if you took a look at any supposed determinant protocol, then suddenly you're going to find that the only reason it works is that there is some assumption that at some stage in the protocol, someone's made a definite choice, tossed a die, made this operation or that operation, or done something which is determinate, it could be written down on a piece of paper. And there's no way that that determinate choice for connecting two operations could not be replaced by an entanglement with an ancilla, where the other party could be aware of that. And if the other party could be aware of it, you'd be able to see in superliminal. So that basically is the underlying proof. The supposed protocols which actually work only work because that's not known. There's some step of the protocol which amounts to an actual measurement or an actual operation, an actual choice, which could always be replaced by an entanglement. Now, I mean, there's one further loophole which one might think exists, and that is one could ask the question, okay, we know that you could always, granted, you could always replace any determinate choice, definite choice, this or that, with an entanglement. But how do you know that that's always going to be an advantage? I mean, maybe there's some protocol where it's not to one party's,
Is the entanglement a kind of way to implement the cryptography?
Is the entanglement a way to implement cryptography?
Can we do cryptography by entanglement?
Cryptography is a very general term. I mean, can we do?
For example, in the case where there's no public key,
yes.
So for example, the mental poker strategy.
Sorry, so in the case there's no public key?
Yeah, so we can use the kind of mental poker way. I mean, for example, you want to send something to me, but you don't want anybody else to see that. You can just encrypt it,
yeah.
Or you can lock it and send it to me,
yeah.
And I add another kind of cryptography onto the message and send it back to you, and then you unlock yours and then send it back to me. Then I can get the information sent to me back. But if in there during the transmission the information was taken by somebody else, but you wouldn't be able to open to decode.
Well, yeah, when we're talking about in this particular case you've got two parties who, there's no third party because they're just two parties who don't trust each other. And I'm trying to implement a bit of a protocol. So we did talk about cryptography before, where these entanglement tricks the situation is different there because you have two parties who trust each other, and a third party, like Eve, who is trying to screw the thing up and make information. And so, trying to intercept it. So the situation is the game is kind of different. I mean, here the game is where two parties don't trust each other. There's no third party because they're trying to set it. But I just want to say that you might, just to sort of end up here, you might think that, well, maybe there's a protocol. What we've seen here is that the entanglement, which can always be done with ancillas, which are calling the EPR, generalized EPR strategy, can always be done to make impossible the existence of a completely secure protocol. But you might suppose that, well, maybe there's some protocol where that at some stage, Bob is supposed to make a move, supposed to do this or that. And it turns out that actually, if he performs the entanglement, which he knows he can with Ancilla, he puts himself in a worse position. He makes it possible, you know, he improves Alice's position for cheating, finding out something. I mean, suppose that's the case, then although he could implement an EPR strategy, he wouldn't, because things would be worse for him. So maybe there's a strategy where you can sort of force something like that by creating a protocol where a party is going to be put in a bad position if they do this EPR strategy, and then they won't, and then the whole protocol isn't secure. Well, you can actually show that that's never going to be the case. It can't be disadvantageous for someone to introduce an entanglement and delay. That always has to put them in a better position, or an equal position. And so that's not an option. Okay, so I should stop here, I guess. I'm going to do one more session, or seminar, lecture, whatever. I thought by now we'd have gone further, but I want to talk about quantum computation. And I'll leave that for next time and try and leave enough time to sort of wrap up with half an hour of discussion at least, or more hopefully, about these foundational questions that I started off in this venture. So next time I'll talk about quantum computation from a kind of geometrical picture point of view. So I want to present a different way of looking at some of the standard algorithms than the usual way. You can actually, I want to present a kind of a quantum logical way of looking at it, where you see how the algorithms work in terms of the subspace structure of open space. So it relates to some of the things that we've been doing here. And then I'll talk about foundational significance. So then just before you guys go, I mentioned that I'm not going to be here next Thursday. So that has to be postponed because we're giving a talk somewhere else. And the following Thursday, there's a visitor coming over here where I'll probably be busy all day. So I'm wondering if it's possible to have the last meeting on Monday week. So Monday instead of Thursday. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
For which Monday?
Well, it would be not this coming Monday, but following Monday, which is like, I think they left. This one is, let's say, 11th.
11th.